I was asked to come and talk to you tonight, something about Christian apologetics, and I'm not sure that that word is even a familiar word to everyone. What does it mean to talk about apologetics? I thought that one of the things I would share with you, a couple of things I've been working on the last few years that have to do with that subject, a couple of them have been published in book form. I don't have any of these. I'm not selling these, but if you're interested, I want to tell you about it, and you might want to find one somewhere along the way. A book I wrote a couple of years ago, particularly having to do with the Bible and having to do with Baptists and our Baptist position on the Bible, what it has been from the very beginning. This book is just called simply Baptists and the Bible. I wrote it along with a colleague of mine, modern technology. Now, if it'll just stay there, right? I won't. Okay. I wrote this along with a colleague of mine who teaches church history. And we went back to the 17th century, not personally back there, but in our research, and located the earliest Baptist writing theologians. And we pulled out of what they did, what they said about the Bible. And then we traced it through every single one of them that we could find from the 17th century up through the 20th century and tried to put together sort of a textbook, really, a kind of a comprehensive reference book. You're not going to sit down and read it casually, but if you want to do some research into this or know exactly what Baptists have said about the Bible, almost everything is here, except, of course, for some of the more recent things that have been said. We stopped our research about 1970. But as you know, if you keep up at all, our whole denomination right now has been for several years sort of in a controversy about the Bible and what do we really believe about it and what do we say about it. And I think you might find it well worth your time somewhere in the next few months and years to do some study in that on your own. In that particular book, we did not say what we thought Baptists should have believed or what they should have said, but we actually went to the primary sources. What did these people who have lived over the last several centuries actually write? And simply from those primary sources, we have put together that book. Now, in the very last chapter, we wrote down what we thought. If you want to know what I think about it, it's in there also. But throughout most of the book, it is simply telling you what other people think. We felt like that was a very fair, open, and honest way to study that particular question. And that is a great deal of what Christian apologetics is about. The word apologetics, it comes from the same word as apology. We say, I apologize. But that means today, excuse me, I'm sorry. And we really don't mean, excuse me, I'm sorry that Christianity exists. That's not how we use the word. The word apology, though, does mean an excuse, but it means it in the more positive sense. If you went into a court of law and you were charged with a crime, you would be offering your excuses, but not really, oops, I'm sorry. You would really be offering your defense, the reasons why you thought you were innocent. You would be defending yourself. Now, the Greek word apology was used primarily in that sense of a legal defense. When someone was charged with a crime, or whether it's a crime or just charged with some other accusation against them, if they made a defense of themselves, made their excuses, made their apology, gave their reason why they thought they were innocent or why they thought they were right, this was called their apology. In fact, if you've studied classics at all, you know that Plato has a very famous writing entitled The Apology. And that is the story of Socrates when he was placed on trial in Athens. And the apology is the speech that Socrates made defending his whole life and his whole philosophical attitude and all the things that he had done in Athens, saying why he thought he was right and the accusations against him were wrong. So when we talk about Christian apologetics, one of the things we are talking about is why do we believe that Christianity is true? What are our reasons? And of course, if we don't talk about the Bible, then what do we talk about? We believe that the Bible is true, and therefore we believe Christianity is true. So what Baptists have believed about the Bible Of course, that's not what all Christians have believed about the Bible, but what we as Baptists have believed about the Bible is one of the ways we say why we think Baptists are right. Why do we believe that Baptists are worth being? I mean, why not quit being a Baptist and go be something else? Well, because we believe there's something substantial. We have reason for being a Baptist. We think Baptists have understood the Bible correctly and have understood Christianity correctly. So, if you're interested in that aspect of it, I would recommend that book to you. Another one that I did just in the last year is called Classical Readings in Christian Apologetics. Now, this is not limited just to Baptist history, but in this particular book, I started way back at in the early church in the year 100 and traced this up through the years 1800, right up to the 19th century. Now, you could have gone right on up into the 20th century, but you would have had another book at least this size just to do the last two centuries. So I tried to cut it off. I went back and looked at the writings of the early church fathers. I looked at Justin Martyr, for example, Irenaeus, Athenagoras. You may never heard of Athenagoras, but he was a brilliant thinker who lived in the second century and defended Christianity before Marcus Aurelius, the Caesar. He actually wrote a document and I think went before the Caesar himself and made a public defense of the truth of Christianity before Marcus Aurelius, asking him to stop the persecution against Christians because Christians were not guilty of the crimes that they were being charged with. Now, that was a very brave thing to do because at that time the Roman government was not particularly sympathetic to Christianity. Athenagoras was successful, however, because along with other Christian apologists, they made the case and they did succeed in getting the pressure removed from Christianity in that sense of strong persecution. Athenagoras gave in his document, known as the plea or the apology for Christianity, gave reasons why Christianity was true and the pagan religions were false. He argued against the pagan gods, why you shouldn't believe in the pagan gods, and why you ought to believe in the biblical God. I also included in this book essays from Tertullian and Origen and Athanasius and St. Augustine, right on up to Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin during the days of the Reformation, and then on up even more recently, Joseph Butler and William Paley. Have you ever heard anybody say, a watch proves a watchmaker, and so therefore design in the universe shows us that there's a God? That comes from William Paley, written in the 18th century. And I have that particular essay where he makes that argument. It's known as the Natural Theology. That's the name of the essay. The first sentence of it, chapter 1, in crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how that stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch on the ground, and it should be inquired how that watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think the answer which I'd given before, that for anything I knew, watch might have always been there, would work. Yet why should not this answer serve as well for the watch as it does for the stone? Well, the reason is that when we come to inspect the watch, we perceive something we could not discover about the stone, that its several parts are framed and put together for a purpose. The inference, we think, is inevitable. The watch must have had a maker. And then he goes on to try to show that just for the same reason you would know the difference. If you found a stone, you wouldn't necessarily think anything about it. But a watch, you would never think that it had just always been there, or that it had just gotten there accidentally, or that those parts had somehow just been flying around in the air and fallen together and sure enough came out to be a watch. Because a watch seems to have a purpose. It has a purpose to tell time. It's put together in a very intricate way. It seems to be arranged, not by accident, but it seems to be arranged with a given pattern. Now, he drew the conclusion that leads anybody to believe that there must be a watchmaker. Then he goes through a rather lengthy discussion about the world, showing all kinds of things in the world that he believes are parallel to the kinds of things he found in a watch. And he concludes, therefore, it is not reasonable to think this world has just always been here, just happened to be here, just fell out this way, things sort of whirling around, and what do you know, they all just happened to fall out in this particular form, in this particular order, with this particular purpose behind it. He says, therefore, it's just as reasonable to believe in God and to believe that there must be a God who made this world. Now, that's the kind of thing that has been typically done in Christian apologetics through the centuries. It doesn't mean that all of the arguments that Christians have used have necessarily been good ones. Sometimes the arguments, even some of the ones that I have in that book, I might not use today. I might think they're not as strong as they could be. Or I might think something else about them. But it's very interesting to study all the way from the very earliest writers, the very earliest Christians who were scholars and who tried to answer these sorts of questions, right on up until the modern day, how people have defended their faith. You see, some people have the impression, I think mistakenly, but it's very obvious that they have it, that Christianity is really just a lifestyle, not something you defend, just something you choose. You choose to live this kind of life, somebody else chooses another kind of life. And many people think of Christianity just kind of as one of many different lifestyles. Some people prefer this way, some people prefer that way. But Christianity is not just a lifestyle. Christianity, as it has been understood historically, is what I call a worldview. And you might want to make, I see some of you are writing this down, put that down because I'm going to talk about that term. And I'm going to talk about what it means, and that will really be the subject that I'm going to concentrate on here in a few moments. Christianity is not just a moral code. It's something much bigger than that. It is a worldview. Sort of as a text, I guess, and something for us to think about and to keep and take with us, I'm going to look at the very last verses of the letter that James wrote. James was the brother of Jesus. He wrote a very short letter in the New Testament. And the very last thing he said in the letter, and you know James's letter is filled with all kinds of interesting little comments and has to do a lot with our lifestyle, the way we live. But let me read you just the last two sentences of the letter. My brothers, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring him back, remember this. Whoever turns a sinner away from his error will save him from death and cover many sins. Now listen to it again. That was just the first reading. Listen to it again, and this time listen carefully. My brothers, if one of you should wander away from his lifestyle. No, that's not what he said. If one of you should sort of go off and live in a way maybe it's out of keeping with the tradition of your parents or something. No, that's not what he says. If one of you should choose to do something that the rest of the community feels like is wrong, that's not what he says either. When he gets to the end of his letter and he makes his final words, his emphasis is not on lifestyle. He's going to talk about the sinner, and he's going to talk about converting him, bringing him back. But he's talking about not just an act which is out of keeping with the cultural pattern or out of keeping with tradition. He's talking about truth. Listen, if one of you should wander from the truth. Now, I don't think there's any question that the truth includes a moral lifestyle. The truth has moral implications. If you wander away from the truth, you're probably going to wander into some sort of activity that is out of keeping with the truth. But the truth is more than just a moral pattern of life. It's more than just things we don't do or things that we do. The truth includes why we do them. What is real? What is the real truth? When we discover the truth, then we say, if that's the truth, then how should I live? And my lifestyle follows out of what I believe. Christianity has an emphasis on truth. And truth is bigger than lifestyle. Truth is much more comprehensive. It includes everything that we believe and that we think and that we do. Christian theism is actually the truth. Christian theism is not just a viewpoint. It's not just my opinion. It's not just your opinion. It's the truth. According to the New Testament, that claim is made over and over and over again. What we believe when we believe in Christianity is the truth. And when people do not believe in Christianity, they are believing something that is false, something that is not the truth. Now you see, that's a very, very strong claim. Do you realize that I'm claiming that all of the people who don't believe in Christianity are believing something that is false? That's a very powerful claim to make. Well, you're going to have to defend that. You can't just say that and get away with it. You're going to have to explain that. You're going to have to give some reasons for saying a thing like that. You're saying that all these other people are believing something false and that only we have the truth. You're going to have to defend that. That's exactly right. That's exactly what Christian apologetics is about. Why in the world would Christians ever claim to have the truth? And why would we claim to have the truth as opposed to other views, which we would then say is not the truth? Well, let me explain it to you like this, and I'm going to do it under the terms of a worldview. The term worldview simply means the way people think about things, what they believe about things. It's the biggest word that I know how to use to describe this. A worldview, the world means the universe or everything you know is in the world, everything is the world, and your view is your view of everything. So a worldview is that most comprehensive way of thinking. Everybody has one of these, though most people don't know it. Everybody has one, but they don't self-consciously know it. They don't articulate it. They don't express it. But they have one. For example, a worldview is the assumptions that you have about what things are and why things are and the way things are. Do you think that the universe is just here by accident, just a fallout from natural processes? Or do you think it was deliberately made by God? Do you think it was purposefully arranged like this? Well, whichever one of those views you hold is a very basic assumption. You either look at the world as something that just happened through natural law, natural processes, or you look at it as something that deliberately was done by someone, by God. That's a very basic, fundamental question. Most of us assume that something exists rather than nothing. Most of us assume that something exists. Now the question is, what? What exists? Something does. Well, the world does. Well, what is the world? Is the world a collection of bits of energy that happen to be arranged in a certain way? Or is the world something else? What is it? Well, when you study chemistry, you get at that a little bit, don't you? You get it there and you talk about the atoms and what they're made of and how they're put together. Well, what are atoms? What does hold them together? What keeps the atom from collapsing in upon itself? If the nucleus of the atom is positive with protons there, and if the electrons are negative, why don't they fall together? Why don't they collapse? What keeps them in tension? What keeps that structure of the atom there? What is it that the world is really made out of? How does it really operate? Now, you see, I'm asking a scientific question, but basically I'm getting at something much more than just a scientific answer. Because if I ever think what the world really is, and if I discover that it just happens to be an energy pattern that just seems to be here for a time and then is gone, and just sort of happens to be existing at this particular moment in this part of the universe, then my life and my body and my activities are also just made up of that, right? I would just be made of atoms and made up of an energy flow, a heat transfer going on. Is that all I am? Am I, as a human being, simply a chemical process? Is my mind simply electrical processes going on in my brain? Or is there something else there? Is there something else that makes up what reality is? Is there something that structures it and organizes it, or does it organize itself? am I made by some deity for a purpose? Or am I just here because I have evolved through long millions of years of process? What am I? You've heard the old question, you know, who am I? That's supposed to be a very profound question. You might not have ever realized why it was so profound. What really it's getting at is this very basic underlying question, what is anything? What is ultimate reality? And then the question I've got to ask also is, how do I know? Even if I have a theory about what it is, I've got to ask myself, how do I know the answer to that question? How do I know who's right? More than one theory can be given. Some people are going to suggest, you've probably heard this suggested yourself, some people are going to suggest that ultimate reality is simply matter, or at least some type of energy transfer within the atoms, at the subatomic level. And those people often will say that if you just give enough time, and if you just have a process of chance going on, and if you have long enough, that even the most improbable things might happen. If I'm throwing dice, it's just happening by chance, but if I do it long enough, if I do it a million times, then I'm probably going to be able to find somewhere that I can get it to come up a certain way. I can get two sixes to fall out there. I've only got one chance out of ever how many it is, but if I do it enough times, then I'll get it to happen. Or something else. Now, some people say the universe is like that. If you give it long enough, and if it's all just by random chance, somewhere you're going to have a world fall out like this, with people on it and with a civilization and so on, because you just got so many chances. The universe is so big, it just happens, so many things happening, somewhere it must fall out like that. Well, others will say, no, behind all of reality there's some kind of spirit. There's either a God or some other kind of spiritual reality that shapes everything and molds it. Well, who's right, and how do we know? How do we solve that question? What is really real, God or matter? What's ultimately real? What ought we to do? Should we live according to the teachings of God? How do we know those are the teachings of God? Should we just live the way we think is best? If we discover how a thing is, do we conclude that that's the way it ought to be? Do we determine what we ought to do based upon what we do? Do we justify ourselves? Well, we did that, so it must be all right. I did it, so I'll figure out some good reason to explain it away or to excuse it. Is there really any meaning or purpose to life? Is history going anywhere? When I look back at what's gone on in my own past, is there any purpose to it? Did it lead me anywhere? Am I just a naked ape? You know, Desmond Morris used that term in a book a few years ago because the word naked sells books like wildfire. He was talking about a hairless monkey, but he used the term naked ape because he knew what would sell the books. But is that what I am? Am I just an animal who happens to have lost most of the body hair and maybe sort of developed some social relationships and language and a few other things? I mean, of course, it's just a more sophisticated form of you know. But because we've worked on it a long time and developed a pattern, we've developed language. Is that what language is? And all of our communication is really nothing more than just a little bit more practice on going And are we just animals that have developed this little pattern of life? Or are we personalities made in God's image? You know, it seems to me that these are not trivial questions. These are pretty basic. They're pretty fundamental. And even if you've never thought about them, and of course you probably have, but there's an awful lot of people who haven't really thought them through, and they don't think of the implications of their answers. There are a lot of people who maybe assume that they are simply hairless monkeys, but they haven't carried that out to say, therefore, what does that mean for my lifestyle? What does that mean for my future? What does that mean about who I really am? These questions are not trivial. They are important questions. They determine our lifestyle. They determine what we think about TV. They determine what we think about movies, how we respond to commercials. When people are trying to sell us something, on what basis do they try to sell it to us? Do you pay any attention to that, or do you just sort of watch the commercials and laugh at them and go on? Or do you ask yourself, now what premise does that commercial work on? What do they think I am? Why are they telling me I ought to buy that product? What are they telling me it's going to do for me? Why do I need that done for me? Or if it's not going to do anything, maybe it's just because I'm supposed to like it. On what basis are they appealing to me? Do you know that advertising people call you the consumer? They think of you primarily as someone that consumes products, consumes goods. So you are a consumer. Well, you do consume things. You eat and you do consume other energy sources and so forth. But is that what you are? Are you essentially just a being that consumes energy, that primarily absorbs things that other people can make available? When I go through my academic life at the university or at seminary or somewhere else, when I go through that, how do I assign value to it? What's the significance of this course? Why am I taking this? I mean, okay, it's part of the core curriculum, right? So I've got to take it. Why is it a part of the core curriculum? What's the value of taking that? What does it mean to me as a person? When I do scientific study, what's the value of doing that? What's the importance of scientific inquiry at all? What about business ethics, economic theories? Let's say I'm going into medicine and I've got to deal with questions of life and death and the ethical implications of my practice there. You know, these questions really are going to face all of us somewhere down the line. What we think about the way the world is and what the world is and why the world is and who we are is going to determine how we live and how we respond in almost every area of our life. Let me tell you what I think is the way, as a Christian, we ought to go about thinking about this. We need to ask ourselves, how do you test these claims for a worldview? Who is right? How do you test them? And you're going to have to apply this test to Christianity too. How do I know that Christianity is telling me the truth when it says there is a God who made this world and that I'm a personality in God's image? I got to test that too. Space and time, that's all. Just the scientific world is all there is. I've got to test that theory. Which one is right? Well, here's the way that you would test a worldview. I'm going to make some suggestions. And then I hope to show you that Christianity meets these tests. And very briefly, I'll point out why I think other worldviews don't. First of all, to test a worldview, I would ask whether it is logically consistent or not. Is it logically consistent? Does it make sense reasonably, logically? Now think about this. Reason itself is something which you do when you think about an issue or a question. Reason is what you use. It's your clear thinking. Now let me ask you, if we really evolved out of just time and chance and impersonal matter, then what is reason? If we came from just random processes of nature, then reason itself must be a product of chance, right? I mean, because there isn't anything else. Ultimately, it had to just come about by chance. So reason itself, clear thinking itself, it just so happens that we think that way because we've just sort of developed that way of thinking. It's not based in anything. It's pragmatic. It works for us. We get lots of good answers when we think that way, and it's very helpful. But ultimately, it's based on chance. Well, do you want to commit your life and commit your whole pattern of thinking to something that is ultimately founded on chance? Just so happens? Just accidentally came about that way? The reason we think logically is just because it just so happens that we do? You see, Christianity offers another answer for that. Christianity says that reason was there before the world was. In the beginning was the Word. You remember that, John's Gospel? The Greek term there is, in the beginning was the Logos, which means reason. In the beginning was reason. In the beginning was rationality. In the beginning was a Word. And that Word was with God, and that Word was God. Reason was there from the very beginning. Communication was there from the very beginning. A word. A word is a meaningful expression of thought. John says, in the beginning, the very first thing that existed was a meaningful expression of thought. A word, reason itself. And by that word, everything was made that was made. There was nothing made without that word. That word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we knew him as Jesus Christ. Now that's what John says. You see, he bases reason itself not as something that just happened, but as something that was there first. In fact, he says the world came into being because there was reason which brought it into being. God intended for the world to come into being. It has a reason for being here. It was made by a self-conscious, personal being. The book of Genesis says that man was made in God's image. That has to mean, it surely doesn't mean that God has five fingers and toes. I don't think it means that. But if we're like God, if we're in His image, it must mean that we're like Him in some way, and I think it has to mean that we too have reason. We can think, we can understand God's thoughts, we can understand the world. Now, you know, that to me is a tremendous motivation for studying science. I love science. In fact, it was going to be my major in college. And when I felt called into the ministry, I decided I should not major in science because I felt like I would be, at that time, I felt like I'd be preparing for a technical scientific field when I needed to be preparing more for ministry. So I maintained my science interest, and I got a minor in it, but I didn't major in it. I shifted over to a different major. But my interest was there. You know one reason I was always so interested in it? Because it was absolutely amazing to me that I was able to think and my mind somehow be able to understand the world. That's really an astonishing thing. Why should my mind be capable of understanding the world? Christianity tells me why. The same God that made the world and who made it by thinking about it and bringing it into being according to His reasonable thoughts made me in my mind and made me in His image so I could think like He thought. Therefore, when I think about the world, I can understand the world. I can actually do scientific research and grasp it, and I'm understanding the truth about it. But I started thinking, what if there wasn't a God and my mind had just sort of developed as a random process? Why would I trust it to tell me the truth about the world? How would I know that my mind was really capable of grasping the world the way it is? See, I wouldn't have any way of knowing that. I wouldn't know that that was true. The only way I have a basis for really believing that I can understand the world scientifically is because reason was there first. Now, when I ask the question, is this logically consistent or not? I find Christianity to be very logically consistent. It makes sense. It explains reason itself. It makes reason meaningful. It gives it a purpose. But when I look at non-Christian worldviews, I wonder, are they really logically consistent? Do they really consistently follow out the implications of their own view? It seems to me that naturalism, the idea that there's only space and time and nothing else, destroys the foundation for reason being a meaningful way to come to know the world. Now, of course, that doesn't mean they don't use it, but I think they use it inconsistently. Only Christians really have a logical basis for believing that reason is useful. Well, let me suggest another thing. Not only do I want to ask, is it logically consistent? I need another thing. Is it really empirically adequate? Empirically adequate. Is there really enough factual evidence to support it? Does Christianity have factual evidence to support it? Or is it just something else? Well, let me suggest a couple of things. I wish we had time to do a long study of this, because this is a real place where there's a lot that could be said. How does the non-Christian explain the fact that most people looking at the world do think of the world as an orderly place? Now, I know that many philosophers, especially those who've thought this through, claim that that's an illusion, that people don't really see the truth. But how do they explain that most people do see order and design in this universe? You see, the Christians explain that very easily. We say it's because that's the way we were made to start with. Order and design is actually there. But let me come at it another way. How does a non-Christian really explain the empty tomb? I mean, there's no question that Romans understood how to crucify people. And they didn't take people down off of crosses who weren't dead. The Romans didn't do that. There's no instance that we know of anywhere in history where someone who was crucified survived it. So the Romans that crucified Jesus knew what they were doing. He was placed in a tomb. Pilate gave permission for it. Soldiers were there to guard it. Now you say, well, that's just what the Christians said. No, if that weren't true, we'd have some documents from that time period. The New Testament's not the only documents we have from that time period. If this were all a hoax, we've got Roman historians who write about that same time period. Why don't they say? Now, the Christians claim that they really put him in a tomb, but we have evidence that wasn't so. But they never claim that. Even the Roman historians simply say, we don't know what happened here. This man, Jesus, was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and the belief of the people is that he was raised from the dead. Now, they never say he actually was, but they don't explain any of the evidence. The evidence was that he was crucified, put into a tomb, and the evidence was the tomb was empty. Do you realize when Peter stood up and preached at Pentecost, and we talk about those thousands of people who came to be baptized that day, wonder why so many people were persuaded so quickly? Don't you realize that most of those people already heard about the fact that resurrection was supposed to have taken place? Many of them had gone and seen that the tomb was empty. If Jesus had still been in the tomb somewhere, all anybody would have had to have done would have been to go and break it open, bring the body out, and say, look, here's this man, Jesus. He's not really raised from the dead. Pilate couldn't do it. The Sadducees couldn't do it. The Pharisees couldn't do it. Even on Easter Day, nobody could find that body. Nobody could prove that it was a hoax. The evidence stands. Empirically, the evidence for Christianity is very strong. Not only the empirical evidence of the resurrection itself, but do you realize that Jesus hundreds of times fulfilled prophecies that had been spoken, some of them thousands of years before, certainly hundreds of years before. And those prophecies were written down and were kept in the Old Testament, which was well known prior to Jesus' day. They weren't things that were written in there later to make it look like he had fulfilled them. They were things that were already written in there. And we even have Dead Sea Scrolls, some of which were written prior to the life of Christ. They were written in those documents. They weren't put in there later. Written in there, held and believed. We've got a Greek translation that we know was done 100 years before Christ. In that Greek translation, there are those prophecies, and here Jesus is fulfilling them, doing exactly what the prophecy said. And sometimes he couldn't even control it. For example, one of the prophecies said that they were going to take his garments and cast lots for him. Well, Jesus didn't have any control over that. He was up on the cross. He couldn't say, hey, now, by the way, we've still got a prophecy to fulfill. You Roman soldiers, get down here and cast dice on my garments now, because I got to fulfill this prophecy. He didn't do that. It was out of his control. And yet, time and again, the prophecies were fulfilled. That seems to be pretty strong evidence that there's something about Christianity that you have to pay attention to. You can't just ignore it. You've got to answer those questions. There are some facts that are basic and fundamental and have to be dealt with. Christianity is not only logically consistent, but it fits the facts. It makes sense out of the evidence. Now let me suggest another thing quickly, and I know we've got to close because you've got to go. Do these various worldviews have explanatory power? Do they really explain things? I think Christianity does. Why are you never satisfied with material wealth? You know, you say, well, if I just had $100 more, I'd be satisfied. But as soon as you get that $100, that's not quite enough. There's still something else you want. I've never known anybody who thought they had enough things. Why doesn't, if we're nothing more than just material beings that have come about, then why aren't we satisfied with material things? Why can't we just be satisfied with, if we could just go out and have sex without any relationship and nobody, you know, don't have any responsibility? Why couldn't we be satisfied with that? If it's just a physical drive, then why aren't we satisfied with the physical act? Why do people think there has to be love involved? There has to be relationships and responsibility, and you want the person to care about you. You don't just want to just be with them. You want them to care. Why? I thought you were just an animal. I thought you were just a highly evolved animal. I thought you were just a physical, material being. You see, it seems to me we're not just that. We're something more than that. Christianity explains why. Because it talks about who we are. And it talks about relationships being basic and fundamental. It talks about what the man and the woman are for and how they're to relate to one another. Even from Genesis, it talks about that. We're not just beings that can meet in the night and pass and never make any difference. It does make a difference how we relate to one another. It does make a difference what our relationships are. It makes a difference to us. No matter what we say, it really does make a difference to us. And we can live a lifestyle that sort of goes along with what the world says, but it will not satisfy us. We will not be happy with ourselves, ultimately. Why not? Christianity explains that. It gives you a basis for those relationships. I think other worldviews do not. And a last thing. Is it practically relevant or not? Is it practically relevant? You know, if you're thirsty, that implies, I mean, you wouldn't be thirsty, would you? Except that there is a way to get something to drink. If we're thirsty, that kind of implies there's water somewhere. Now, we may not find it. We may die of thirst. But, I mean, we wouldn't exist with these desires if there was no way to satisfy them. If there was no water in the world, we wouldn't exist as thirsty people. We wouldn't be able to live without it. Our thirst sort of tells us there must be some way to quench that thirst. We also have spiritual hungers and spiritual thirsts. Is it really true that no matter how spiritually hungry we are, that there really isn't any food out there? There's no reality? We desire God, but there isn't a God. Now, see, that doesn't prove there is one. I'm just saying that Christianity not only is logically consistent and empirically adequate and explains things, but it also does give real practical answers to practical needs. And I suggest that other worldviews do not have answers to those questions and do not satisfy those needs. According to James, if one of you should wander from the truth, if one of you gets caught up in one of these other worldviews, if one of you starts believing that there really isn't a God, that relationships really don't make any difference, that really there isn't any basis for Christianity, if you wander away from the truth, and if someone should bring that person back to the truth, by reminding them and recalling to them the significance of Christianity as a whole and what it means in general in our life. Remember this, anyone who turns a sinner away from his error, whether it's a moral error or an intellectual error, anyone who will turn a sinner away from his error will save him from death and will cover many sins. You see, ultimately, no less is it true now than it has ever been. One of these days, all of us face death. and what we believe is going to be put to the final test. If we've rejected God and we have to face Him, then we're going to have to explain ourselves, make our apology. Paul says in Romans 1, those who look at the world and don't see God are without excuse. They won't have an apology. They won't have an answer that will satisfy God, because God has made Himself known. From the things that have been made, He's made Himself known. And He now commands all men everywhere to repent and through Jesus Christ come to faith in Him. That's what Christianity is all about. It really is the truth. It really does describe the world as it is. It's not just a way to live for a while and maybe just sort of a good lifestyle or some activities. It really is the truth. And on that basis, with confidence, we can live our life and relate to one another and do our academic studies, do our business life, whatever we're in, on the basis of truth itself, proclaimed in this New Testament, lived out in our lives. Christianity is the truth. Would you bow your heads with me for a moment? Our Father, we rejoice always when we come to a new consciousness of Your presence, of Your reality. Help us never to think of You just as an abstraction or just as a feeling, but to know that You're a personal being who truly exists, who truly loves us, who knows our thoughts, our motivations, sees our heart from the inside out. We don't always live up even to what we know and believe. But we pray that You will constantly make Yourself known to us, encourage us, for we need encouragement, strengthen us, for we surely need strengthening, and give us confidence in our witness and in our daily life. We make this our prayer in the name of Jesus. Amen.